Hello and welcome to the Carolina Pitcast. This is Finn McConaghy. Today we have Daniel Anderson, who is the director of the Carolina Digital Humanities, as well as the director of the Digital Innovation Lab at the University of North Carolina. He studies digital rhetoric, teaching with technology, and alternative approaches to scholarship. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you, Finn. I'm really happy to be here.
We're glad to have you. So I kind of want to break down a lot of these aspects in your bio. Obviously, you do a lot here. And as somebody that's involved in the Digital Innovation Lab, the Pitt Journal, I was really interested in this part that is digital rhetoric. So explain to me what digital rhetoric is to you and what sort of work you're doing with that.
Yeah, rhetoric is the study of how people communicate, and digital is just what happens when we fold computers into that. I've been doing this since the 90s, and there's always been something new. The World Wide Web came online in the 90s, and then iMovie and multimedia comes along. So a lot of it is comfortable, similar things. So when you think about communication, there's an audience and a speaker, and you have a purpose, and there's traditional ways of using rhetoric to communicate and get a message across. And those hold true, but then they also shift when you start to think about, how do I do that with video or like this with a podcast? What's different?
Yeah.
So you get that traditional rhetoric, but, you know, new modes folded on top of it.
I thought it was really interesting. I did some research and I pulled a quote from your website. It says, "How we think shifts when composing for the screen. Words join moving images, sounds, and the windows of the desktop. The performances link the writer with the computer and the network." And if you could talk to that, just sort of how rhetoric evolves when it's on a digital format.
Absolutely. So in addition to maybe using images and sound in addition to words, those are the materials that you're using. What shifts is the tools as well. So if I'm just doing verbal rhetoric, I could almost do that in my mind, thinking about language, or I could talk with someone, or I could write it down with a pencil. When I start to move on to the computer screen, then I'm using a piece of software, and the screen itself, even the computer interface, is a tool that mediates the kind of writing that you do. So what I'm arguing is that when you move to a computer screen, everything is shifted because I'm clicking on things. There's layers of material that I'm looking at, and that is different than if I were writing a linear string of words on a sheet of paper.
Right, right. And what about the shift in audience too? Obviously, with the internet, it's a lot more accessible. And I see that you've done a lot of research on social media specifically too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the nice things about this is the democratization that can happen when you move to digital spaces. Prior to these developments, you had to have a publisher, a lot of infrastructure to get your word out. And now you really just need the phone that's in your pocket. And so you can reach a lot of people. I think that changed things a little bit, but also maybe didn't in some ways. Yeah. Like, just because there's now a million people you could reach with your Instagram posting.
Right. Changes what sort of credibility you need, I feel like, or how many like hoops you have to jump through. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And I guess I'm starting to become a little bit more skeptical of some of the initial claims about how the internet was going to really be revolutionary and an unalloyed good. I think the more you recognize, so it's really easy to post something on Instagram. Yeah. And I can post a slideshow that says, here's three tips for starting college or something like that.
Yeah.
But somebody probably already posted that or something like that, very similar. So how many more postings do we need with kind of the same information recycled? And I think you're starting to get a kind of flattening of information online that's just the same stuff. It's more about circulation as much as like the one-on-one messaging or the, you know, deliberate connecting of an idea sometimes.
It's almost like an oversaturation. Yeah. I see also that here in your bio, it talks about alternative approaches to scholarship. And so I feel like that is just natural with social media, with this digital form of rhetoric. What sort of research have you done into that? And what have you found to be most successful?
Yeah, quite a bit. This goes to conversations that might be happening up a level in academia. So among faculty, among scholars, researchers, particularly in the humanities, which, you know, anyone can talk about this. And we do talk about this at all levels, but it's what constitutes knowledge. How do you create new knowledge? How do you share knowledge? And the thing about academia is the behaviors are pretty ossified. Like, they're doing academics the same way they were doing it 20 years ago or 30 years ago, even though the internet has come along. And this, in many ways, applies more to, say, well, now it probably applies to science as well, humanities. You publish in an academic journal, there's a model that you follow, and that's sort of the currency of academic work. So my thinking is that that can become rigid. And if we're all about being open-minded and finding new ways of developing knowledge and discovering knowledge, if we're using the exact same method the whole time over and over, we might be shutting ourselves down for something. So that's where, if you use media, let's say I'm going to use the material of sound. What could I do in an academic essay using sound that's different than if I were just using words? And that goes to not just using my recorded voice, which is sound, and that has a different materiality than if I take in words with my eyes. So there's a little bit of a difference there. But if I'm using sound, I could put the sound of a train horn or a baby crying or a cow mooing or something like that. Is there a way in which that conveys information differently than even words that were recorded through my voice?
Yeah.
So I would argue, yes, like when a baby cries, there's something emotional that uses the register of pathos that I'm going to feel something. And I'll get an understanding, this is distress, and I'll even get a persuasive message, I need to get up and do this thing. It's not the same as if I put together three paragraphs about how to intervene when a child is in distress. I would be almost immersed in that emotional sound that was coming, and that would be my takeaway. So that's just like an extreme version of the argument that if we're just going to write with words, maybe we're leaving some stuff off the table. Mm-hmm. And what happens if we move in these other pieces? Does that create alternatives?
Yeah. What do you think would be the evolution of this? Do you think that VR could be really helpful with that too? Or just to add to the visual side, then you also have sounds too?
Yeah. Like, this conversation that we're having here, I think, is a nice evolution because it has more of a back and forth too.
Right.
Another overlap here has to do with time and distance. So typical academic article, it gets captured and put on paper, and then somebody reads it somewhere else. They might email you later and say, I have a question about this. But if you can have a more kind of immediate, multivocal kind of scholarship, what would that look like? Academics do that all the time when they have a conference. Right. So they might have a panel and people would argue back and forth. That seems like a nice development. So something like that. VR, I'm not 100% sure, but I could definitely see how the idea of being immersed, if I'm trying to get someone to feel something as well as think something, then putting them into an environment or a space seems like it could have some good possibilities.
Yeah. Okay. So to touch on that conference, sort of the dialogue between, or an evolving dialogue that's happening as these ideas are coming or you're coming up with them, I see also that you wrote that now at this time you feel scholarship can be repetitive and also combative.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what sort of approaches can you take to make sure that it's not combative when you have some sort of discourse?
Yeah, I think it's actually easier when we're next to each other at a table than when we're doing this on paper to some distant kind of interlocutor. And a lot of this I still trace to the rigidity of academic approaches in many ways. So, and it goes to genres. The ways that genres work is they accomplish certain kinds of work. And if you take a typical academic article, at least in, say, literary studies, the humanities, history, they tend to start by putting on the table what someone else has said. Here's the argument of X, or here's what the field has thought for the last 20 years. And then they bring in the counter argument. This is why that's wrong. Or here's where X missed the point, all of that. Yeah. And so there's this sort of headbutting that takes place intellectually in a lot of academic prose where people are in competition. It's a competition of ideas. I'm not opposed to the competition of ideas, but I think alongside that, we could have other approaches.
Right.
And so if you say, one time I wrote an article that used no buts, no howevers, no all those, like all of these conjunctions and phrases that are the equivalent of saying, that's not right, here's what's right. And I just use and. So someone puts an idea on the table, it's the improv prompt where they just say yes and. If someone puts an idea on the table, what you do is you accept it and you extend it. You don't accept every wild idea. If something is problematic, then you say, no, I can't accept that. But otherwise, instead of immediately trying to win an argument, see how you can build on what someone has said.
Right.
And that's a different way of writing, but comes across pretty cool.
Okay, so I'm going to shift topics a little bit. I also see that you've done a lot of research and publishing on wellness. And so I wanted to see why you find that so important and what you've discovered in your journey.
Yeah, I was reading some of these wellness books. This linked up with the pandemic. So there was a lot of mental health struggles and people trying to figure out how are we going to support people in this challenging time. And this is basic rhetorical work. When you start reading, if you're in an English department or what have you, you have a pencil in your hand and you're marking stuff up and you're trying to read on top of or beneath what the words are saying. And I just started to notice all of this figurative language that jumped out at me. And some of them are really obvious, like people will say wellness is a journey. And so I started to just mark that. And the more you mark it, you recognize some patterns. So what does it mean that wellness is a journey? You start to realize that, well, journeys have a destination. So what does that mean when people say, I have to set a goal? And sometimes they set too big of a goal. All of the literature will tell you, take some small steps. So make some little habits and build on them and you'll get where you need to go. So that journey metaphor actually is really apt for trying to give people good advice. Hmm. But then I noticed another thing was like most of the writers occupy this kind of guide role. So mythologies will tell you most of the journeys, the protagonist eventually meets some character, some old man with a cane or a witch in the woods or something that gives them the wisdom that they need. So it turns out the way that the writers produce these books follows that model. And they often say, oh, here's a little secret. So there's sometimes like a little talisman or a secret in the book eventually becomes this sort of talisman that's going to allow you to take the wisdom of the guide and move along. So that's just one example of why I found it rhetorically interesting the way that these books work. Other ones are a little bit less expected. So there's a lot of battle imagery. You wouldn't really think of that because you think if people are giving advice about wellness or talking about wellness, it would be focusing on positivity. But they're always talking about defense mechanisms, strategies, tactics. And it turns out that, you know, wellness is a journey, but it's also a battle in some ways.
Yeah.
So you get attuned to these ways that people are talking and you get a kind of different understanding of how people are teaching wellness or writing about wellness. The real trick, I think, is eventually to see if you can translate that into some paradigms or tactics that might help people feel better, do better, have more wellness. I'm not 100% sure. It gets really cliche to say, think of wellness as a journey. Everybody's already got that one on the table.
Right.
But are there some things that maybe you could adjust in the way you use your own language or the way you are using verbal thinking to build on some of these insights?
Do you think that this like heroic monomyth almost then of this journey that you're following and you're almost following like the hero's journey is helpful then for wellness? And then also, do you think the battle imagery then is like a call to arms to better your own health and well-being? Or
Yeah. You know, I think awareness of how these things work would be helpful for people in many ways. So like sometimes the journey metaphor could definitely be a challenge if someone says it's really easy, just get your map in place and take the steps. And it's not really easy. If someone uses that journey in a different way and says it's okay, you might have a detour or a setback, but that's okay. You're making progress if you zoom out or something like that. So, you know, it's, I think, how you deploy it in some ways. And there's a lot of these. There's the one that shows up a lot that also speaks to intellectual work and how we explain things is rewiring. So people are always talking about brain activity related to wellness and how can we maybe change the way we're thinking in some ways. And they use this kind of computer metaphor of you can upload a new software for your thinking, or you're going to rewire your brain as if there's soldering irons and all of that. But it's a useful shortcut because it's essentially telling you you're not stuck. You can make some change.
Right.
And the rewiring helps you recognize, oh, I could do that. Of course, what they really mean is you have to practice some different habits or change the way you're thinking or talking or something like that. And it's interesting because the scientists will use all of these concepts as well. So when they're writing for a public audience, they'll switch to this metaphorical language. And even in their science writing, they'll use metaphorical language quite a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's really interesting. I think that being able to recognize sort of the rhetoric that you're reading and be able to analyze all this is really important. And I wanted to talk about the 105 writing program, just because I feel like that's where you earn or gain that foundation, that foundational learning and that rewiring, if you want to call it.
Makes
so
sense.
How did that come about? I know that you were the founder of that and have directed that for a while. So just walk me through that process.
Sure. Yeah. You know, English 105 has been on campus since campus started, really. It's a couple hundred years old, first year writing, and every university has a first year writing program. I've been doing the directing of it for the last 4 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have enough rhetorical training that I understand the mission of what they're doing in English 105. I enjoy doing that. One of the really nice things about it is it's a very successful program, and it gives first year students what they need to be successful in college for the long run, because it not only teaches about writing, rhetoric, and communication, but there's a really strong research component. So by the time you finish English 105, you should be pretty well prepared to do written communicative work in college and also know a lot more about research.
Yeah.
So it's a great way of launching into your university activity. The other part about it is you're learning how to learn in some ways as you come to college. And because it's got this kind of workshop environment with peers, and it's a small class, and there's room for you to make mistakes and recover and figure things out. It's a really helpful class for just your overall attitude and posture as you move into the university as well. So I really enjoy working with that program because it's such a valuable class. I think it adds a lot of value. It's a required class.
Right.
So students are sometimes hit or miss. It's a mixed bag when you have to take a class.
Right.
But I hope that it adds good value.
Yeah. Where do you think it's headed in the next few years, just with maybe some sort of alternative scholarship?
About 10 years ago, maybe even 12 or 15, we added a multimedia component to the class. So the class does have a bunch of outcomes that it tries to meet. And one of them is a oral communication outcome. So like this conversation that we're having right now, in most English 105 courses, you give a speech or you do a podcast or something like that, and you create a digital project. So I think we're doing well at keeping up with where composition is in the world right now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you need to be able to work in a digital space, and you need to be able to be a good communicator, both written and spoken. So it's in a really good spot doing all of that work already. We're figuring out how AI can complement that rather than undercut that. So that's a big project we're working on, is figuring out how to support AI integration in a way that furthers intellectual activity rather than undermines it. So we're working on that. There's always a lot of kind of operational aspects because it's a big program. So staffing and making sure there's all the outcomes are being met as you have a large scale operation. That's a sort of management challenge there.
Okay. And then what about the conference that we worked on?
Yeah.
Where does that sort of play a role in it?
Yeah, the Pitt conference is linked up with English 105 courses. Not every English 105 participates in this, but there's always a cohort of hopefully usually about six or eight sections of English 105. And one of the things that is a tenet behind English 105 is that writing, it's not always, but in universities and in most social situations, writing is a kind of public act. So you don't write just to put it away in a drawer. You're writing because you're trying to make change in the world. You're trying to join some kind of conversation or entity. There's an outcome for the writing that usually is linked with public activity.
Right.
So what these courses do is really leans into that. Not only is it going to the 20 other people in this classroom, but we're going to bring six or eight sections together, and then we're going to have a public conference. So you'll present your work at this conference, your research, you'll get feedback on it, all of the things that really make writing stronger. You're invested in it. People are giving you ideas about it. And so that's how these courses are developed. The students in those classes, they work on a research project, and then they do their public speaking about their project at this large public conference. And then they take that feedback that they get and they turn that project into an article and they submit that to the Pitt Journal, which is a public venue for their polished writing that other students might read or anyone in the world really could read. That's just an online journal, but it gives them a chance to really make that more authentic, this idea that I'm not just writing for myself.
Right.
I'm writing to do something in the world, to join a research community. And that's what these classes do.
Okay, well, I want to ask or dive deeper into this Pitt or People, Ideas, and Things program. Could you give me a layout of what is under this umbrella, how you came up with it, all that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the People, Ideas, and Things, there's a little bit of theoretical underpinnings to that because there's a theory that's been around for about 15 or 20 years called actor network theory, and it falls into a category of post-humanism. So you can think of the humanities as a big bucket of how you organize the world. And it would put people in the middle. We're looking at what humans create, their art, their interactions, those kinds of things. And over time, people started to recognize that that's not actually a really accurate view of how the world works. People are really important, but you know, when the weather comes, we could be completely overwhelmed by nature.
Right.
A virus, some other organism, animals are really valuable.
Yeah.
So people got this kind of corrective mindset of saying, we might have been on the wrong track by saying people are the center of everything for a long time. And people weren't actually saying that exactly, but the paradigm was humanists, humanity, people is like this central idea. And so this notion of post-humanism comes along and says, let's correct that a little bit. Let's add some understanding of the way that the material world influences what we do. Objects, things are really important. And even ideas are not exactly people. There's this some kind of strange philosophical entity called the concept of freedom or the concept of independence or of connection. So people, ideas, and things is a more complex kind of contemporary nuanced way of understanding how intellectual activity works or how it's situated. Yeah. So that goes there. But it also is a nice acronym that overlaps with the Pitt on campus. So the Pitt on campus is this central hub where everyone could come together. And that's this nice idea of the public space where this happens as well. So that's
more inclusive. It's more about the relationships between all of these things and, I don't know, powers sort of.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when you teach Now, how do you write? You don't just say there's a speaker and there's an audience. That would be this like two people as the center of the whole equation. You say there's this context, this right. material thing that's influencing it, and there's events that are playing out, and those are shaping yeah. what's happening. So you have a much more kind of networked idea
yeah.
of how writing takes place and right. how you do research and all of that. So that's happening underneath this
yeah.
PIT model. And then the program itself started out as just a publishing venture. We decided, why don't we take articles that students are writing in English 105 right. anyway, and we'll turn them into a journal. We'll have an undergraduate journal linked to the writing program. Right. And a lot of writing programs have that. It's a really nice venue because it ups the stakes. It really gives you a more authentic investment in right. what you're doing if you're sending it out for publication. We started that when the concept of crowdsourcing okay. was really big, which was about 2010. There were a lot of books being written about crowdsourcing mm-hmm. and people were like figuring out, was this a whole new paradigm for how work works as well? And that's connected to the internet. So, you know, as the internet took off, a lot of people started to use that space to solve problems. So even companies would say, we're having trouble figuring out how to get the last bit of toothpaste out of the toothpaste tube.
Right.
And they would post it on some bulletin board and amateur scientists or something would come in and all the package designers had tried everything and couldn't figure it out. And then some electrochemist came in and said, no problem. We just change the ions to be charged this way. And then we charge these other ones negatively and
right.
it'll come out by itself. So you get somebody who's adjacent but distant, and right. they have a different idea. That goes to the alt scholarship thing too. If you're talking to the exact same people all the time, you're going to miss out on
right.
some ideas. So that was a big part of it, is this notion that there's wisdom in crowds.
Okay.
And so that translates into having writers and students and people participating in the journal activity actually making decisions.
Yeah.
about what gets published. And rather than a top-down model of here's an editor that's saying this is what we're going to put in the journal,
right.
maybe a bunch of this activity can be bubbling up a little
yeah.
bit more.
So. And even the behind the scenes, is it's very interactive with, of course, the podcast as well, with the conference. It all builds on top of each other. And then even in the editing process too, I worked for a school newspaper, but with the PIT journal, it's very different. It's more in the hands of the person writing themselves. And the editor is, instead of giving them strict things to cut or add, almost guiding them through a process, because you want that genuine, like what they, why they created this writing and then what they're writing from, like their experience. You don't always have that same perspective. And so you want to help guide them into the path that then sort of fits into this. And the fit is very broad too, because it's yeah. all people, ideas, and things, you know?
Yeah, I really like how you're putting that, Finn, because it makes me recognize one other aspect of this, is that the instructional paradigm behind, say, teaching writing, teaching right. English 105, is not disconnected from the operational paradigm of the PIT journal and
right.
how you edit it. It's almost like an extension of teaching.
Yeah.
Teaching happens in this writing class. And in that, you don't stamp on someone's idea. You help them bring their idea out and figure
right.
out what do they need to get where they're trying to go. And then that teaching sounds like it's happening as well when people are working with authors in the journal
right.
as well.
Yeah. yeah. Teaching is always happening. It's just that in this way, it's more genuine, almost more creativity based.
Yeah.
So you were talking about crowdsourcing and this idea that putting a question out to a crowd and receiving an answer because people are from all these different backgrounds, are able to work on it. This sounds similar almost to artificial intelligence. And so I know that the PIT has been working a lot with AI and seeing how it can help, how it can harm. I wanted to pick your brain on artificial intelligence, where you see the PIT going with this, where you see writing going with this.
Yeah. Yeah. I do think it's impressive that the AI tools have been able to bring together so many texts. Like they're trained
right.
on a whole bunch of ideas and writing that right. people have done. There's a ton of ethical and intellectual property questions associated with that, but we could put those to the side for now and just say they've been able to bring together a whole bunch of texts,
right.
which is impressive, and then figure out how to use math and computation to make sense. And in some ways it is crowdsourcing if they take the most probable outcomes that are going to show up when you bring together these massive scaled right. amounts of text. That's what the crowd would organize in some ways. So yeah, I could see that. The challenge there is there's so much that happens before any of that takes place. And you need to have that activity keep happening after the tool is built. So
right.
that goes back to writing and what is the value of writing or what is the value of language. If the value of language is just to put together the perfect combination of words that's going to make somebody click on your Instagram right. posting or right. something like that, then a very efficient scan of what's been effective before and using math and probability to make those words could do that job. But writing and thinking are like intimately connected.
Yeah.
And so if you don't have all of that knowledge already, how are you going to get that knowledge without using words to think through the concepts?
Right.
This is the concern that most writing instructors have with AI. If you just press submit and get something, but you're not actually thinking about it.
Right.
And if you haven't already developed literacy ahead of time,
yeah.
then you're going to get short-circuited. Mm-hmm. You can get the output from the AI, but you need to you already need to know what that output would be. If the AI is saving you labor on something that you could already achieve, then no problem.
Right.
But you need to be able to achieve that before you go for the labor saving
right.
piece
right,
as well. Right. And so that's the danger. And it's not going to be that we decide we're not going to replace thinking with AI or we are going to replace thinking with AI. Where we need to go is where those complement each other and our thinking takes place in yeah. concert with AI. Right.
And becomes more efficient, maybe.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. We can add efficiencies. And like I always use this example, if you are writing your citations in your paper and you accidentally got them in APA format and the editor says, I need them in Chicago style, mm-hmm. you could have a computer just change where the punctuation goes and
right.
all of that. No problem, especially if you understand why those styles are in place and you understand it, then get the computer to do that. That makes really good sense. But if you're trying to figure out how do these three stories that I just read relate to each other, mm-hmm. writing about them is one of the ways you're going to process that
right.
and get the ideas organized.
Right,
it slows
right.
down your thinking when you write.
Yeah.
Because when you're just thinking, everything's just a jumble. When you write, you can't think as fast as you can write. So you're like pausing.
You're choosing what to use specifically.
Totally. Yeah. yeah. And you're organizing too mm-hmm. as you're writing. So we have to have those mental processes
right.
going on one way or another.
Yeah.
We could probably build an AI that does that, that prompts you and says, take three mm-hmm. ideas, chew on them,
right.
come back to me in 5 minutes. Like you yeah, could yeah. do that, but the efficiency short circuit is not going to take us there probably.
Right. That doesn't make life easier.
Yeah.
yeah. So what sort of work have you guys been doing with AI? I know that there's a whole AI side to the pit, at least.
The AI work that we've been doing has been linked to English 105.
Okay.
A lot of it, as much as to the pit. And one way to understand it is to go back in time to like 2022 November when ChatGPT came out.
Right.
And the initial concerns were very much like policing type concerns, like somebody could cheat, somebody can easily plagiarize. Right. Another initial concern was biases and misinformation. So these
yeah.
texts are all, the training of these tools is all on a certain set of texts, and those texts have some biases in them. The way that AI functions is it wants to provide you a response, even if it doesn't know the answer. So it's going to invent information if it doesn't
right.
have the information. So a lot of the initial concerns were, we have to watch out for that. Let's put some boundaries up, or let's give people some warnings and red flags. So we started building out modules we got a grant from the School of Data Science and Society, and we worked with the university librarians and developed an AI literacy initiative. And a couple of our first tools were along these lines, like how do you avoid plagiarizing, how do you spot bias and all of that. And that was like necessary work. On top of that, we started to go to the next stage, which is how do we make sure this doesn't replace our thinking? How do we complement intellectual activity with AI? And so we started to build out training and modules about things like prompting. If you just take a response from a prompt and paste it into your paper, you're not really thinking through. Right. So if you get a response from a prompt and then you evaluate it and you bring your own background knowledge to it and you say, what are the strengths and weaknesses of this prompt? What is it missing? Let me go back and prompt it again and say, it looks like you're missing this. I need you to give me something a little bit different. Mm. And you have a back and forth, a dialectic with the AI tool.
Right.
Then you're thinking. Because you're evaluating what it's giving you, you're revising it, and you have a meta awareness of what it's giving you. So we started building out that kind of training and support for instructors so they can, some of them just want to make sure nobody's plagiarizing, but eventually we're going to want to be sure that we know how to use these tools to, to think.
Yeah.
And so that's, we've built modules and they can go into a Canvas website and people can download them into their class and kind of just a lot of support materials for people doing English 105. Hmm. Yeah.
That's fascinating stuff.
Yeah. And on the Pitt side, we've been using the labor saving stuff for some of the podcasting. So a lot of people have just been thinking of AI as ChatGPT, but there's a ton of other AI tools. And after we finish this recording, you'll probably put it into the AI cleanup thing. And wherever I say or ah, except for those two times, because those were deliberate and ahs, it'll actually, it's not smart enough. It'll clean those ones out too, maybe. So that'll create a problem. But the tool can fix stuff. And, and if I'm speaking too quietly in one segment, you used to have to by hand go into your audio editor and look at the spikes and like clean all that up. But the computer's really good at doing that stuff.
Yeah. Makes my life easier.
Yeah, sure. Definitely.
I guess just to conclude, what sorts of resources and opportunities can these listeners check out if they're interested in exploring more of your stuff, Pitt Journal stuff, Pittcast?
Yeah, totally. The Pitt Journal, it's just pittjournal.unc.edu. And then Pittcast is pittcast.unc.edu. So you can go to those sites. The podcasting is really great. We've been doing that for the last couple of years and I enjoy that a lot. And those are on Spotify as well. So people can track those down. If you're on campus, I would go to our Heal Life page. It's People, Ideas, and Things. If you search on Heal Life for People, Ideas, and Things, you'll find our organization and you can join it. If you join the organization, then you'll get the contacts. And if you want to become an editor for the journal, you can start to join the group. And I would really encourage people to do that. I think that takes it to the next level. You can go consume some of the stuff that we're doing, but if you participate, you're going to, it's going to be a whole different experience. If you have time and energy and want to do something a little co-curricular, if you love writing, if you're interested in communication, then join this group that's working on that stuff in a professional way. And then that's going to just complement what you're doing in class.
Awesome. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. And thank you, everybody who's listening to this right now.
Awesome. Thank you, Finn. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.